On this week's Devils in the Details, it's our season review, and we welcomed the great Brent Maximin to help us make it extra special. We discuss United's player of the season, who are the contenders and our picks to win it, best and worst performances of the season, how do they compare to last season, and our favorite moments from the season, from funny to exciting to hopefully not sad, but you know what season it's been. Case, speaking of which, it has been quite the season. You are about to embark on a few weeks of traveling, which means we won't be covering the FA Cup final. How have you been, and how ready are you to get this season and hopefully era over with?
I'm very ready, but I want to go back for a second, Aaron, to something you said earlier. You called Brent great. I know you do that every time we have an intro, but I feel like we have to have a standard here. And we can't just go calling everyone great, because then when we have someone who's really, truly great on, it ceases to have meaning, you know? So I think, you know, it's a warning. Going forward, be a bit more careful. But yes, I'm...
It was actually...
No, please, fix it.
In my defense, it was in the contract to get Brent on here that I had to refer to him as the great Brent Maximin. I couldn't say Brent. I couldn't say what I really think, but...
I see.
Anyway, I think we should welcome Brent before we continue to defame him. Today, we welcome Brent Maximin to the podcast. Professionally, Brent is a psychology professor, but in the football world, you might know him from his time as editor of The Busby Babe, which is one of my personal favorite United fan sites. Now you can mainly find him at LogoffBrent on Twitter, but of course, that's at your own risk. Brent, thank you so much for joining us. How are you today?
Doing great. Obviously, it's built into my legal title, yes, the great Brent Maximin, so I'm contractually obligated to be referred to. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome. So a little overview of the episode here. What we're going to do is we're going to have three discussions. We're going to do player of the season, and for each of these, we're going to do a top five. I'll be doing the top five for player of the season, and then we'll be able to discuss it with everyone else. Case is going to be doing our top five performances of the season, and then we're going to go to Brent for our top five moments of the season before we talk about looking forward to the summer and maybe some no details. Are you guys ready to get going with this? Are you ready to hear the top five players from this phenomenal season?
Yeah, let's get it over with.
All right, so player of the season. I found first to fourth really easy, but for fifth... We had some discussion before the podcast, and Case and Brent actually don't know who I'm going to pick here, but I'm going to give three honorable mentions first who came up in the discussion but are ultimately not going to make my list. Firstly, we have Maguire. Redemption season for Maguire. I think the reason why he doesn't really make this list is because the defense has generally been awful, and I don't think he has particularly moved the needle towards fixing it. So in the context of a season, I don't think that he has had a particularly notable year in terms of impact on the team, but I think on a personal level, he's had a good year. Andre Onana, top for minutes for United this season. Some models have him as the best shot stopper in the Premier League this season, but because of his Champions League displays earlier in the season, I think there could be an argument that he's the primary reason why United got eliminated in the group stages of the Champions League. And so for that reason, I felt like I couldn't include Onana in my top five. And then finally, I'm going to mention Scott McTominay, who is United's second top scorer from open play this season, or from non-penalties, I guess, with 10 goals. The reason why he doesn't make the list is because I don't think outside the goals he has had a particularly strong impact on matches, but scoring 10 goals is something significant, and I think in general, we have been McTominay doubters on this podcast, so it felt to me like he deserved a mention for the fact that A, I think he has contributed to a lot of positive results in a difficult season, and B, the fact that I don't think that his goal scoring is entirely lucky. I think if he is played in a similar way in future seasons, he will continue to score goals. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the top five first and then open it up to discussion. Okay. At number five, I have Kabi Mainu. At number four, I have Rasmus Højlund. At number three, Alejandro Garnacho. At two, I've got Bruno Fernandes. And then at one, I've picked Diogo Dalot as United's player of the season.
Okay, so I have the same top five, actually. Before we came on, this is funny. Aaron said to me, he's like, who would you have fifth in your, you know, your top five players for this season? And I had like a few players come to mind, but then I realized I was forgetting somebody. I was forgetting Garnacho. And so it became pretty clear cut to me. So, were you considering someone else over Mainu? Because to me, Mainu has to be in the top five this season, personally.
I was considering the three that I gave as honorable mentions, but mostly a few reasons. One is, like I said, I don't think Mainu's actual impact on matches has been as great as the potential that he has shown. And secondly, he hasn't played that many minutes. I think he's totaling at about just under 25 90s at this stage of the season, which is less than both Maguire and McTominay and half of what Onana has played. And so I felt that Onana being largely good over a stretch of nearly 50 matches, some could argue that would weigh in enough for him to be fifth over Mainu. But then with the Champions League taken into account, I think it made most sense to go for Mainu. And then I also think it's the most exciting option. Like, Mainu has been the biggest source of joy for fans, I think, among these four this season. I guess you could argue McTominay's goals have been enjoyable, but I feel like Mainu has actually given us promise that this midfield could be good at some point in the next 5 years, which for me means more than a couple of results this season that have not really amounted to anything in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, I had Mainu as firmly as my fourth.
Okay.
To be fair, I did kind of forget about Rasmus Højlund. But I think... and then the rest of my top four is the same, slightly different order. For my fifth, maybe this is a cop out, but I'd pick anyone from Højlund, Onana, or Maguire for different reasons. I think each have a decent case to be in that fifth spot. Onana has been good. Except for the fact that he single-handedly crashed us out of the Champions League. Kind of significant detail. Maguire, redemption season, but also hasn't been available for much of the season. I mean, none of our centre-backs have been available for much of the season. And then Højlund, who had a good middle third of the season and has... probably at the very least met expectations, if not outperformed expectations, given that he wasn't supposed to be the only leading striker in this team this season.
Yeah, I'm pretty similar to you, Brent. I have Højlund fifth, and I think he's definitely the one where I could hear an argument for somebody else over him, just because he's had the availability issues and... also, okay. He's had the availability issues, and also, yeah, the first 15 matches of the season, he didn't score in the league, which like that matters. As good as he was in the Champions League, he's sort of been he and Onana have sort of had opposite seasons, where Højlund was great in the Champions League, Onana was catastrophic, and then Onana's been available the whole season and broadly good in the league, whereas Højlund's had multiple spells out with injury and been super inconsistent. Like, he's gone stretches. He had that stretch at the beginning of the year that was super, super, super poor in terms of output. So yeah, I think he's the variable for me. And then also, Aaron, I have Garnacho over Bruno. I think he,
okay. Yeah. I'm receptive to that. I think I ultimately, so for Højlund, I looked at the minutes he played ultimately, and it ended up being the fifth most in the squad, and the fourth most among outfielders. Among those minutes, he scored 15 goals, which is, and none of them from penalties, which is 5 clear of McTominay in second. I also have felt that, not that the team has ever been good, but the stretches where it has been more tolerable have been the ones where he's been able to get the ball at all in games. And I think that speaks to the difference he makes in the side. So I didn't have him as like a contender for player of the season, but I felt in a top five, I thought fourth was like a reasonable compromise for that level of performance.
Yeah. I just think with his, like, it, just looking at the 90s, he's, like, the minutes he's played isn't necessarily a good, like, heuristic for his availability, because he's played every minute when he has been available, which isn't true for other players. Like, there just is no other striker in the side. Anthony Martial, obviously, we can talk about that later.
Martial has played 7.190s this season, so, yeah.
Only other center forward in the side. It's, you know, it's kind to even call him that, because he's basically, like, non-existent when he's on the field. And has almost certainly played his last match at Old Trafford, which is quite sad. And if you go back 10 years, I think we all would have been surprised to hear about the last 4 years of his career. But yeah, I think that's just for... I agree with everything you said about Hoyland. And I agree with what Brent said. I think he met, if not slightly exceeded, expectations this season. But I think on balance, it was fine. I think the guys I have ahead of him were super exciting. Either were super exciting, like Garnacho and Mainoo were just clearly one of the best players in the side, even though had really rough patches like Bruno. And then Dalot, who I think was just consistent, which is crazy. Like, I think Dalot is the clear player of the season. And it's not like he was spectacular. He was just, like, never the reason we were losing. Which is, like, a really, you know, I guess depressing way to look at the state of affairs. But
yeah, I kind of understand putting Garnacho over Bruno. I think I erred on the side of caution. Partially, I do think Garnacho has been, for long stretches of the season, United's most threatening player. But I think in terms of influence and, like, overall performance level throughout the season, I feel like you've gotten the normal season out of Bruno that you'd expect, which as a baseline is probably United's best player, possibly United's second or third best player. And so it's probably a safe choice to pick Bruno over Garnacho, but I feel like...
Yeah. I have a slightly different take here, because so I have Mainoo fourth. I think, like Aaron said, his value or the excitement about him is in as much about his potential as the difference he makes on the field right now. But that said, relative to our midfield options, he makes a huge difference. In the second half of the season, he's clear for his choice. So he's been an ever-present in the side. So I have him fourth. He's also been involved in 2 or 3 of the best 5 moments of the season. So that also counts for something in a disastrous season like this one. I have Garnacho third. Been exceeded expectations, I think, in productivity. Gave us, spoiler alert, best goal of the season. Also been used like a bar of soap. Is this true that he had never started more than 2 matches in a row as late as November? And then he's played the last 36 matches in a row in all competitions.
That sounds right. I believe it.
I think it goes to show how good he is as well. I think the amount he has played has kind of desensitized people to just how good he is at this age. The goals and assists he's provided, the work rate and tactical flexibility, like he's been switching between the wings.
Yeah. And we probably would have appreciated it even more if he wasn't overplayed. You know, he's looked physically jaded a bit lately. And that's the manager's fault. And I actually have Dalot in second and Bruno first. Dalot's been an almost consistent player This is his highest level season. Established himself firmly as, well, first choice right back, second choice left back, at least. And yeah, overall, probably our most consistent player, but Bruno is still the best player in this team. Still the most integral to the way the team plays. Still probably has the most relative value in terms of how hopeless we look without him, which is not often, because up until this got him injured, Bruno had never missed a game with injury. So he's always there, and I think it's to a point where we probably take him for granted. And, you know, if you compare his levels this season to his, I guess, his peak at United, he hasn't hit the same heights. But when he's been good, he's been really, really good still for a team that is largely dysfunctional. So I still have Bruno as our player of the season, even if completely understand going for Dalot.
Yeah. So I guess I will take on the role of like why I didn't pick Bruno is basically I agree with everything you said. Again, he's clearly the best player in this team. I don't think it's particularly close. When we are playing well, it's because he's playing well. But I do feel this team has this condition where like they just play into the most hectic, insane game states possible, and they never slow the ball down. And I don't think that's his fault, but I do think he relishes it and doesn't see it as a problem when I think it clearly is one. And in a way sort of feeds it. And so the matches where we've been really bad, he's played a big part in it, in my opinion. And so, yeah, I guess I have Dalot over him. Less because I think he's, like, I think Dalot has probably had less positive impact than Bruno, but I also think he's had far less negative impact, if that makes sense. And that's, like, not a commentary about how I think Bruno will be going forward. It's just, I don't know. The end-to-end football this season, where, like, there was a run of games where there were, like, 10, 15 matches, and I swear it was the exact same game script in every match, became so dreary for me. And I think Bruno was a big part of that.
Yeah, I actually think I agree with you, right? Because Bruno's default is to play football like there's a shot clock, right? And I think because of our lack of coherent structure this season, anytime we conceded, which was often, and were chasing a game, which was often, that space was filled with Bruno ball, because this is Bruno's United, for better or for worse. So anytime we're behind, the team adopts the identity of its best player, which unfortunately the default, our best player's default setting is chaos. And that's fun when the team is good, when we're constantly chasing games and leaking goals left and right, not so much.
One more question on Bruno. We've seen some rumors that Ornstein did quell the rumors, but they haven't quite died off, that Bruno could be interested in leaving this summer. To what extent do you think that will be a problem for United versus an opportunity to build for the future?
I think for the most part, it would definitely make United a lot worse in the short term. But if you got, you know, there's a price tag at which I would sell Bruno. And that's not because I think he makes this team worse. Just because he's at a certain age where I don't think United are going to win a league title while he's still good, to be quite honest with you. I think we're at least 3 years out from that. Been saying that for 10 years. But I think he'll be past his prime by that point. And if you can get a lot of money for him now and reinvest in younger players, I wouldn't be totally against it, even though I can't imagine this team being any less watchable than it was this season. So that's my take.
Yeah, I don't see it. I don't see the point in cashing in. It would have to be peak, you know, market insanity.
Yeah.
At the level of, you know, when Neymar left Barcelona for PSG, you know. So Bayern Munich was one of the clubs that were reported as being interested. They paid, you know, nine figures, 100 million for Kane last summer. Even if they were to pay the same thing for Bruno, how far is that going to get us? A Bruno replacement is going to be expensive. It's going to take up most of that budget, while probably not giving you anywhere close to Bruno's productivity. 100 million just doesn't go as far as it used to. And it would be one thing if, all right, when we cashed in on Van Nistelrooy, because same thing, right? His timeline was different to what the younger stars in the team, what their timeline was going to be. We don't have any kind of creative force, I think, that Bruno is keeping out of the team or is stopping from playing a style that better fits those young players. If we had a player or had players to that level who were suited to a different kind of style that would have more freedom without Bruno being an ever-present on the team, that would be a different story, but I don't see it.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. I think a lot of people have this picture of like Bruno thrives in a certain style of play, certain game state. Most elite teams play slightly differently to that game state, or at least that game state as we've seen it at United. And so therefore the team might get better without Bruno. I don't think that line of logic works because it assumes that the team is otherwise good enough to compete with those sides that you're comparing United to. When they have never been. They've never been as good as, you know, Arsenal and City have been this season, like Liverpool from 5 years ago, other sides in that tier. United are just not competing with them. And maybe when United are competing with them and have players throughout the squad that are close to Bruno's level, there might be a different argument, but right now there isn't. The other thing I'll add is that I think Bruno, like a lot of people have this picture of United of like, it has to get worse to get better. Or, you know, you have to sink into this rebuild and go fully in. And in terms of the recruitment and the coaching, I largely agree. But I also think it's not realistic to say Manchester United can just finish eighth for another two seasons. It's going to be something that from a shareholders, from a board, from a like team front office, fan perspective, very difficult for a club like United to actually take. And so I think having a player like Bruno who can just carry the next few years of the creative burden of the team could actually be something that makes this transition period a lot more bearable than it might be without him.
I take both of your points, but I will say, Brent, to go back to your analogy, 20 years ago, you know, when United are transitioning from sort of, you know, one generation to another, there was, like, the reason you could do that was because you had Rooney and Ronaldo and, like, this other very, very young set of attacking players who weren't actually probably going to produce immediately at the same level as the players they were, you know, replacing. But ultimately, in the long term, yeah, I think we can say quite confidently we're a lot better. And I do think there is a parallel to today. Like, you have Garnacho and you have Hoyland, who I think I have a lot of confidence in to be very, very good. I don't think either of them is Wayne Rooney. But I do think there is a parallel there. Yeah, that's it. And I'm not uncompelled by what the two of you said. I hear what you're saying. In fact,
I do think a key distinction I would make is that Van Nistelrooy, Rooney, Ronaldo were all sort of, maybe less so Ronaldo, but Van Nistelrooy and Rooney were both seen as strikers at the time, I presume, whereas Bruno is more of like a behind the striker, and his inclusion isn't really mutually exclusive with players like Hoyland and Garnacho, in my opinion.
I don't think Rooney's, I think it was more complicated than just the two of them play the same.
He definitely played in a number of different
Brent
roles.
Brent would know better because we were children. So.
Yeah, it was more. It was stylistic, right? Whereas, you know, Van Nistelrooy was more of your last line striker, thrived on service. And we saw, like, when Louis Saha signed, how much more fluid the football could be in terms of what it brought out of Rooney and Ronaldo's game with us, a striker who would come deep, you know, run the channels, spray the ball out wide, you know, more of what we would have then they would have called a more modern number nine, right? So Rooney and Van Nistelrooy and Ronaldo could have all coexisted in the team, but stylistically it wasn't, it was an awkward fit. Where with Garnacho and Højlund and Bruno, I don't necessarily see that, even though, well, Højlund notoriously hasn't gotten the ball a lot from anybody in the team. But I think Bruno still fits alongside players like Garnacho, Menu, and Højlund. Whereas with Van Nistelrooy, it made sense for the style of the team was moving towards, for the play to be geared towards Rooney and Ronaldo rather than getting the most out of Van Nistelrooy.
Did you feel that way at the time?
Yeah, somewhat. But I think, look, Van Nistelrooy is one of my favorite players ever. So yeah, I know that. Was not happy. Definitely was not happy to see him. To see him go, but we are talking about young Rooney and Ronaldo here, you know, players whose talent was evident even then. And yeah, you could see, you know, the difference in how they were able to express themselves on the pitch and the type of football we could play with a player like Saha in the team compared to Van Nistelrooy, you know.
Interesting. Well, I think it's an interesting conversation either way, and we'll see how it plays out. I don't think he'll leave, so I think it's kind of pie in the sky. But
yeah, I don't think he'll leave either. And I don't think that the arguments that Bruno and maybe to a lesser extent Garnacho are the main problems in Højlund's service this season. I think the main problem is that United haven't been spending time in the attacking half of the opponent compared to previous seasons. And I do think one thing we might get onto later is I do think there's room for like a fourth piece. I think you're looking at kind of an attack next season of Højlund, Bruno, and then maybe Garnacho or Rashford. And then you're going to want a different type of winger on the other flank to whichever flank Rashford and Garnacho are playing on. And that might also influence how we see the balance versus having these like three goal scoring striker types with Bruno just essentially spraying the ball behind them, trying to find them, and United not having much time in the attack. So I think a little bit of remodeling could really change how people look at Bruno, as well as the younger forwards in this team and the ability for them to coexist in the side. So I tend to think Brent is right on that. I think with that, we should move to part two, which is our top five performances of the season. And I'm going to hand this over to you, Case. I've got United's games from the season up, so I am carefully taking notes while you give your top five here.
Okay, so I wasn't going to do honorable mentions, but because you did, Aaron, I have two honorable mentions that came up in conversation before we came on. And those are United's loss to Spurs in match week two back in August, where I think United were overwhelmingly the better side, especially in the first half. And then the win against Luton Town, where I think it was only a 2-1 margin, but I think we, generally speaking, outplayed them. Which is, just for what it's worth, as the 6th and 7th best performances of the season is, like, horrid. This was a really hard question. But the rest of my top 5, and I don't know that I had these in a particular order, but we can debate that later, are as follows. Yesterday's match against Newcastle is in my top 5. The 4-3 victory over Liverpool in the FA Cup, partially because of the moment, less so the performance. I think United were really poor for spells in that match, but
stealing Brent's flow.
Yeah. I feel like in a season like this, the moments are going to come up throughout the episode, right? Because the moments are all there was. Like, it, there was no moment where I, there was no stretch where you were like, oh, we're going to turn this around. This is going to be good. The win against Chelsea in December, I think, was a genuinely positive performance despite having a lot of the same problems. The League Cup opener against Palace, which I think was a 3-0 victory, relatively uneventful. One of the only matches I think you can say about, you can say that about this season. And then finally, I have the 3-2 win over Nottingham Forest in the league back in August. Early red card. We go 2-0 down, then a red card. There's a red card in there somewhere, but we win 3-2. And I felt that was a pretty comprehensive performance, except for the set-piece goals early on.
I think that's a good list. The Liverpool one's really interesting because I feel like it was extra time when we've talked about, in quotes, the sliders a lot this season, but that was a great example of United going 100, 100, 100 on the sliders and it actually working and looking very, very good for extra time there.
Well, I think it helps when you have a completely exhausted opponent, right? Like,
yeah. Well, it does, but then you also do, like, they had to survive the first 90 against them to begin with, so.
Yeah.
It's kind of exhausted opponent against exhausted opponent, but it, yes, still, it still does benefit from the stretched late game states that occur in major cups when matches go late or overtime or lots of added time, as well as the pressure and the, I think a lot of the onus or the, rather, incentive becomes not to concede or and to calculate your risks, whereas in league football often it goes very differently. So yeah, it definitely benefited from the specific circumstances of that match, but that's the most I think contestable inclusion. Did you had the 1-0 loss to Arsenal from this weekend?
No, I had the 3-2 victory against Newcastle from yesterday.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That was a good performance. A lot of really good individual performances as well. I thought the Forest game was good. The Palace game was, like you said, uneventful. Amrabat played left back in that game, and I remember thinking that could be a thing, and it proved to absolutely not be a thing.
Well, it was a thing in that we didn't have a left back playing left back most of the season. So.
And then the last one was.
Well, we had the Liverpool FA Cup match, Chelsea in December. Those are the other two.
Oh, Chelsea. Yeah, Chelsea. That is the McTominay brace.
Yes.
That's
correct.
That game, United put like 4.5 XG up. Chelsea put up a solid 2.
Yeah.
But it was still pretty interesting. And I remember that being like a big moment when people realized that Chelsea's issues weren't just a lot. There were a lot of theories going around at the time that Chelsea were just underperforming on their XG and they would begin to converge and climb up the table. But for me, that felt like a moment of actually seeing that they had a lot of issues playing out the back. And I remember the press, which had been pretty futile all season, being quite successful in that game, which was also pretty fun because you just kept getting these high regains and then like huge chances. I think that's a good list.
We outshot Chelsea in that match 28-13. Which I think 13 has got to be like the fewest shots we've given up all season to a top half opponent.
That's awful, but it might be.
Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't have to answer this question. I mean, I think Keith has a good list, but when I was looking through our results, our list of results from this season, I realized I don't know if I can pick 5 90-minute good performances. We had so many performances where they were great for 75 or 80 minutes, or we had a good first half, or a good second half, or a good 30-minute stretch either side of halftime, maybe, that we ruined by giving up cheap goals, poor substitutions. Champions League performances, there are a couple of them there that were ruined by, let's call them, individual errors. I don't envy Case having to pick 5 good performances minute 1 to full time from this season.
I have a sort of leading question here, which is, What are some of the performances that stand out to you guys from last season, and how do these compare to those? To me, off the top of my head, the 2-0 against Spurs last season, as well as the win over Barcelona, come to mind as matches where I really felt like we were watching a very good team. Whereas in these matches, it feels like we're watching a not-so-good team have a good game.
Yeah, I think there were more matches last season where it felt like we were watching the start of something. And there were many more matches this season where it felt like the opposite. Like, it felt like that nobody had any idea what we were supposed to be looking at, what this team was supposed to be, which of course, you know, colors your perception of, because you could pick a losing performance or a match where we dropped points last season and feel more excited about the performance because you see the performance as an indicator of something more. Whereas even some of our wins this season just felt pointless.
Most of our wins, I think.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think this is maybe slightly a stretch, but I honestly don't think it is. You go back to the 7-0 last year, the loss to Liverpool, and you take the first half.
That was a better performance than most matches this season. Yeah,
I don't know about most matches, but like a lot of matches this season, it was a better performance then. Especially if you take the first half, like the first half of that Liverpool match, where we went down 1-0 to a, I forget who scored the Liverpool's goal in the first half of that match.
I'm not looking it up.
Yeah, fair enough. But we go down 1-0.
I remember being with Brent when that happened, though.
Yeah, I was in Mumbai. I was at the Man United Mumbai like bar. And I'll tell you, those guys were chanting like well past full time, despite the fact that we were like into added time, giving up more and more goals. It was a pretty cool atmosphere. But nevertheless, my point being, what was I saying? You take that performance, that first half performance, it's one of the best halves we would have played this season, which is pretty nuts if you actually think about it.
Yep. Would any games from this season make the top five from last season?
Well, let's think. What's the top five from last season? It's probably the Spurs match.
Barca.
Barcelona, the second leg or the first leg. Both of those were pretty good.
Yeah, I think the draw against Chelsea comes to mind.
Yep, draw against Chelsea.
Maybe not.
No, the first half in particular was really good in that match. What else? Those weren't the only good performances.
There was a stretch for like 2 or 3 months where United were just good against the bottom
half.
Well,
I want to flesh this out though, just to see if anything from this season makes the top five from last season.
Oh, the Manchester Derby was a big one, I think. The home win against City, who went on to win the treble.
Were we all that good in that match, though?
I don't think it was amazing, but
yeah.
Can you imagine that happening in this weekend?
Not really. But then again, they did thrash us in the FA Cup final last season as well. There were a few performances around the new year. The 3-0 against Nottingham Forest, which would have been easily first this season. We had the 4-2 against Villa. There's a lot of options here. Yeah, nothing in the top five this year makes the top five last year, I think.
This is an incredible run of results, actually, when you look at it. It was like December 21st, 2022, which was the EFL Cup round of 16 against Burnley, until
Liverpool 7-0, really.
Until the 7-0, there was one loss, and it was against Arsenal, and they won it in like the 90th minute. And United did get a little bit, they did get a little bit walked over that game. But besides that, they were largely very good on this run, picked up a lot of points. Rashford scored a ton of goals in that stretch. I don't think United have produced anything of that caliber since, and there weren't really many times before that. Post Ferguson, that they were playing at that level.
Yeah, best
which
stretch.
Is an interesting point of comparison.
Yeah, probably best stretch of like combination performances and results. I mean, obviously we had a good run of results under Mourinho, under Solskjaer, especially during the interim period. But yeah, that stretch on the Ten Hag might be the best stretch of combined results and performances post Fergie. So Ten Hag tricked us. I think the only performance this season that has a case to be up there with the best of last season is against Liverpool, FA Cup.
Yeah. Yes. Definitely. I think, actually, this is a great way for us to transition to moments, I think. Because the thing that really carried that, I think, was that was such a fun match to watch, right? And, like, the most climactic way to win it possible.
Brent, it's time for you to give us your top five moments of the season. And I'm going to take a guess that Ahmad's goal against Liverpool is one of the five.
Oh, yeah. I spent a lot of time researching this. I watched a bunch of match film. And by that, I mean, I looked at the list of results for about 45 seconds and came up with these five.
You had me for a second there. I was like,
yeah.
Really?
That's- Yeah.
I was like, we sent you the outline not long enough ago for you to have done that. But
okay, top five moments of the season for the senior men's team. Most disappointed Manchester United team this season, for the record. Garnacho's goal of the season, the Everton bicycle kick. I mean, just in what a, that's a goal that you remember forever. Like, it doesn't matter that it was a match we were winning anyway, at Goodison Park, meaningless, random. Without that goal, we still get 3 points. Without that win, we're still probably where we are on the table. So low stakes, but the goal itself is one of those that you talk about for the rest of your life. Incredible. So that's number five.
That's five. Wow.
That's five. I just really quickly, that was the first or second minute of the game as well. Yeah. So I was actually in the elevator up to watch the game.
Casual.
And yeah. I think I scared everyone in the elevator watching the game on my phone. I think it's one of those elevators that, like, when you jump, you have, like, a small chance of breaking the elevator. I think I almost broke the elevator. Yeah. And I would have incurred a massive fine if I did. Yeah. So, yeah. That, I'm surprised that's at five.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm curious to see. I need to know what better there was this season.
I may rearrange this. This may shock you, but I actually haven't put a ton of thought into this. So I may rearrange this ranking. But that's in my top five. The comeback win, the 3-2 against Villa. Garnacho double, Hoyland winner, Stretford in 83rd minutes or 84th minutes or something like that. I mean,
that was his first Premier League goal.
The parallels with our other 3-2 win against Villa at Old Trafford. I mean, very different. That was a match to secure the league title. Essentially, when Ronaldo scored the double and Makeda scored the third one. But there's something special about beating Villa 3-2 at Old Trafford that I love.
I assume Makeda's going to come up again here.
Oh, yeah. McTominay double against Brentford. 93rd and 97th. What an incredible robbery of a result. Just out of nowhere, off the bench, yeah?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought United were actually the better team that game, but it needed a McTominay and a bunch of set pieces to actually show it.
I turned that match off. I missed both of those goals.
Casual.
I know.
I was laughing hysterically for several minutes after the end of that match. So stupid. But so good. Like, this is what it's all about.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, we're about to send on our seventh best central midfielder, and he's going to score a double in the 93rd and 97th minute to break the hearts of all the Brentford supporters.
Those are also his first goals of the season, if I recall correctly. He had scored for Scotland, but he hadn't scored for United yet at that point.
Cheers.
He went on to score 5 more by the end of the calendar year, and that match was in October.
That is real Barclays right there. Real Barclays. I love it. It's the player we all groan to see coming on. It's like, here comes McTominay, match over. He's coming on to give the ball away. Brace. Incredible. And then, of course, Maino's winner against Wolves. Just incredible goal. Incredible timing. From probably the brightest spark of this season, right? We just found a potentially world-class midfielder of the type that English academies almost never produce for free, you know? He was just there at Carrington. Ten Hag doesn't deserve him, but different story. Quality of the goal, timing of it, the fact that this was another drunk Barclays occasion. What a goal. And then easily the number one moment of the season. Ahmad. Yeah. 4-3. Stretford end against Liverpool. That's a career defining moment. That's the thing you your family, the fan base, everybody remembers forever.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the difference between Ahmad having been a footnote. Like, let's say that doesn't happen. I think he probably leaves this summer. Yeah. I don't think United fans even remember him in 20 years. Like, you mention him and say, oh, yeah, sure. Now, bring him up. That's the first thing everyone will think about.
Oh, yeah.
I also think he has a legitimate shot. Like, at that time, he wasn't playing any minutes. He got brought on once, and he did that.
Yeah, I think it genuinely may have turned around his United career. Like, I think it may have saved his United career that moment.
I don't think this is going to happen, but if for any reason United actually win the final next Saturday, that moment becomes, like, that becomes not just the moment of this season, but probably the moment of, like, the decade so far, maybe.
He's a cult hero forever.
Yeah.
If we win the FA Cup, I mean, that is 30 years from now, you know, Old Trafford will be singing his name.
Yeah.
Good list.
It's a good list. I don't even. Maybe Garnacho fifth is bad. Right. I wouldn't disagree with any of those. I think you got the order right.
Yeah.
Not bad for 45 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny season, right? The season has been so unsatisfying. But for one, I mean, our goal of the season, the contenders.
Ridiculous.
I think we scored like the top 5 goals in the league.
Insane. Insane. I mean, just wasted them, right? Like,
yeah.
We get this incredible Kobbie Mainoo goal to scrape a win against Wolves. We get this goal of the decade contender away at Everton in a 3-0 win. You know, just none of our matches this season have meant anything except for the Liverpool FA Cup one. But we've had so many good moments and good goals.
Yeah. In terms of other big moments, I feel like most seasons, I mean, obviously we crashed out of the Champions League, so it doesn't really matter at this point. But the Onana's save against Copenhagen, like the penalty save, that would be top 5 almost any year, I think. Like a Champions League match, like literally last kick of the game.
Similar to Ahmad, it would have helped if United had gone through in the Champions League. Yeah. I think then people would talk about that. Like if Onana hadn't made the other mistakes and he saved that penalty and then United went through. But that's a very different set of circumstances, I guess.
Yeah. The other ones that come to my mind, none of these I would have over your 5, though. Mainoo's other goal against Liverpool, the sort of the turn. That's why I thought you were gonna. In my head, I was like, oh, the because it's so reminiscent of that Makeda goal that I assumed it was going to come up, but it doesn't fit. You're right. And then I think those are probably the other two that are like really noteworthy. Am I forgetting anything, Aaron? There've been so many great goals, so it's
definitely you're definitely forgetting something, but nothing comes to mind.
Dallo's winner against who was that?
It was a Sheffield United.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, that like I said this a few weeks ago. People are gonna watch back the highlights from this season, and they're gonna be like, "Wow, this United team must have won the league."
Yeah,
and then they're gonna look at the league table and be like, "What?
Oh, yeah. Like, we have made an incredible TikTok this season
compilation."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a good season, but what a comp! I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Teenagers in like a decade will think this was like the peak entertainers. Like this was great football. This was the stuff you were missing.
Yeah. This is what propaganda is made out of.
Yeah.
We are going to, as soon as we actually win something, we're going to rewrite history on this season so horrifically.
I mean, they buried us. They didn't know we were doing this kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, just war criminal level of propaganda.
Okay. Hopes for the summer. I feel like Case and I have talked about this quite a bit, so I'm going to go to Brent first. What are your hopes for the new regime in this summer? Maybe you can give up to 5, but you don't have to since I'm putting you on the spot here.
I think probably the first hope is to clarify the managerial situation as soon as possible. I think there is no point letting it drag on. At various times over the last few months, I felt like there was no point even keeping Ten Hag. I also think if the FA Cup final is going to be decisive in whether he stays or not, then this regime doesn't have as clear of a vision as they should. If they don't know by now, that's a problem. So that's the number one hope, that they have some clarity. In my view, I think Ten Hag has done enough to undo whatever hope and optimism I had for him last season. So, and I also don't subscribe to the fact that we shouldn't sack Ten Hag because there's no obvious clear candidate out there. We've been down this road before, right? We did that with Mourinho, where he was kind of a lame duck, wasn't fully supported, entered into this toxic situation at the start of the next season, only lasted a few months anyway. So Ten Hag has 1 year left on his contract. If he's not the guy, get rid. Get somebody else in. Move on.
Mourinho is actually a great example, because whatever you say about Solskjaer, for me at least, it was definitely better than Mourinho. And he wasn't even someone who was, like, he wouldn't have been like a, who are we going to get that's worthy to replace Mourinho? He wouldn't have been in the top 100 on that list at the time. But it was still better than Mourinho.
Right, because it got...
And so if you feel like the current project's not working, you just got to try something else.
Yeah, because it got so bad that anybody would have been better. And we're in danger of that happening with Ten Hag. So clarity on that number one wish. Second wish... actually, my second wish is not even for the men's team. My second wish is for the women's team to actually get attention. Because I think after last summer, or when Casey Stoney left, there was a lot of worry that the team would take a huge step back. Now having like won the cup, and, you know, there are a couple of important players we need to be able to keep and make some strides forward in the league. So I think for the new regime, it's really important that they show that they're taking the women's team seriously.
Yeah, I've seen some rumors of big players leaving. Yeah. I'd like to follow the women's team closer than I do, but I've seen some rumors of big players leaving, which is never what you hope to happen when you have a few promising
Yeah. And I mean,
results from
your season. And then, you know, and it feels like the team is, I mean, it felt like this last summer too, right? Where the team is kind of at a crossroads. It's where it's like, okay, if they're given some investment here, they can take the step to the next level. If not, you know, we can just end up another disappointment. So,
yeah.
What's next? Oh, next, finally being able to be decisive around squad bloat, more so than incomings. Actually, I know we have a number of holes in the first team and in the first team squad, but we also have some exciting young talent that may not physically be ready, but could fill some gaps. But the only way they're going to get the chance to fill those gaps is if we clear out this squad bloat. I mean, I listened to the last episode, right, when you guys did keep or sell, and it was what, half the first team squad or more that you'd be happy to get rid of. So yeah,
and consensus too. I don't think anyone would really disagree. Yeah,
we just need to be much, much better at that. We can't go into another year. I mean, it won't be as many players as need to leave. The number of players that need to be moved on won't be moved on in one summer, right? Some of those players will hang around the squad. Some of them will probably go on loans, just for to get them off the wage bill temporarily. But I would like to see the new regime really get stuck into moving in your Donny van de Beek fake, right? clarifying the situation at centre back. One of Maguire and Lindelof probably have to be moved on. We know that Ferran is leaving already. We need to move on Aaron Wan-Bissaka. We probably, there are a couple of younger players we need to move on from. Hannibal, for example. And there are a couple of expensive mistakes that we need to just accept the sunk cost on and move on from also, like Anthony. Jadon Sancho.
I actually, it's interesting. I think, I don't think everyone who should go will go, but I do think it could be the biggest clear out since Van Hal first joined. In that you've already got, it doesn't look like they're going to sign Amrabat. Reguilon's already gone. Casemiro looks like he's heading out. Varane has announced he's leaving. Martial has announced he's leaving. Looks like Wan-Bissaka might also go. That's already what, seven? I think you're likely to get possibly even one or two more above that, which, it isn't everyone, but it's a pretty good start. Evans, I'm pretty sure, is also gone. Eriksen is probably gone. He still has a year, but there's been a lot of talks about him leaving. He has spoken throughout the season about being unhappy about not playing as much as he'd probably like to. So, yeah, it seems like a lot of players could actually go. And relatedly, I don't think United will be able to sign 10 players, and I don't think they should try. But I think that leaves room for a kind of Van Hal-esque 10 youth debuts next season type scenario where you have the first team, you get some injuries, and then every time you see a new youth player in that position coming up. And I don't think that's like the ideal scenario for a squad, but I do think it's better than, you know, 30 matches from a 28-year-old who we know is not providing the level of quality that United need. I would rather see a 19-year-old who might provide the quality they need, has sell-on value if they don't, and at least you're seeing the start of a Football League career that you're contributing to, instead of just kind of wasting the space on players who are, honestly, at this point, many of them I think are barely Premier League level in what they're providing United. So,
agreed.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything you the two of you said, the managerial situation, I feel like, is going to inform the squad situation so much. And that, I think that's, for me, one of the biggest frustrations with not having it sorted out by now, is contracts expire at the end of June, and he's still going to be in place in early June, because the FA Cup final is that first weekend, I think. Do I have that right? I think so.
It's next Saturday.
Next Saturday.
So it's May, yeah, okay, so 25th. It's,
yeah, so basically...
he probably will still be in place, yeah, or just left.
It's very likely. You got about a month on those expiring contracts, and then you've got the transfer window opening. It just seems like a bad... I don't see how, at this point, you can be ready to do all that needs to be done this summer. Because I agree, Brent, I think you need like 12, maybe even 15 of these guys to be out the door. And you're right, Aaron, there's already been a start on that with the expiring deals. But yeah, next season, what I really hope to see is new manager, and the only players who are playing for United are players who in real time are making the team a lot better, who are already in the side, or are new players who we see as part of the future. Like, those are the only players I want to see playing for this team. It's really hard to, like, buy in when there's so much deadwood.
Yeah, that's something that has come up in many of these falling apart seasons. The squad has just been really big. A lot of players aren't playing minutes, and then by extension are unhappy. And that's not really something that's in the manager's control. To whatever extent, I do think Ten Hag could have given more players more minutes, Ahmad being a clear example. One thing I will say is I agree with the point that the sooner you get a new manager in, or the sooner you clarify Ten Hag's future, the sooner you can make arrangements and plan for a massive summer. I think the one consolation with respect to the expiring contracts is I don't think there's anyone who has an expiring contract that we would want United to be renewing. I could be wrong about that, but I can't think of anyone whose deal expires at the end of June who desperately needs a new one, and for a manager to come in and make a decision. It feels like a lot of players who regardless of who the manager is, they should be leaving.
Yeah, I think it's just, I mean, I think we know all those players, right? So Ferran has already confirmed he's leaving.
I just remembered Heaton's also going, right?
So not that he's never played, so I don't even...
No. I think Pulisic will also go on the top of the list, I said before. Van de Beek, surely. Sancho, very possibly.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think there are only really... Of those players that we've talked about that should be moved on, how many of those are players you would think, or maybe a new manager would want to take a look at them?
Not a lot.
Yeah. Sancho, maybe. End of list.
That's probably
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
yeah.
And even Sancho.
And
I don't know. You're right that maybe some manager would. I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. Like I don't need to see him play another minute for United personally.
He's also not necessarily scheduled to leave at this point. So it's not like there needs to be an immediate... I would like for there to be an immediate decision, but
yeah.
He's not one of the ones on the chopping block right now, weirdly. He's kind of in limbo as well.
But also one of United's few sources of potentially of transfer funds.
Yeah. I mean, do we think Antony leaves this summer? I think probably not.
Probably not.
Yeah. Which
I would, I think it's time, but how many years are left on his contract?
Three.
Maybe two or three more? Three more? Yeah. I mean, I think I could see, if you sign a winger, I could see him getting loaned.
Yeah. Who's paying those wages?
I don't see someone paying yeah.
Yeah. It would take a pretty decisive move from the new director of football to say, let's cut our losses.
Yeah.
Because we're not recouping anywhere close to that fee. And even less so, given into account that whichever club is going to come in for him, will not be able to pay the sort of wages we have him on. I think he's on 200k a week. Yeah. Christ.
Yeah, I do think in spite of not being able to sell him, possibly struggling to sell Sancho, I do think most of these other players will be relatively easy to move on with their contract scenarios. You might be reliant on someone to bail you out for Casemiro, but the rest are low contract or low fee, easy to do deals, I think. Easy enough.
Yeah, I mean, Lindelof should have a line of suitors in Serie A.
No details. Yeah. This is the segment where we allow you to ask anything you like, but with one exception. The questions cannot be about football. And this is going to be a special no details because it's our first no details with a guest. And also, I think a guest who will be really great for no details. Case, what do we have from our audience this week?
I've got two questions. I've got... First one is a more serious question. We'll go with this one first. This question is from Tunde. And Tunde asks, single greatest piece of literature you've ever read? Brent and Aaron are sitting in semi-stunned silence.
I think I could come up with an answer.
I'll start it off. There are a few books that I considered for this. I'm going to cheat. I'm actually going to pick a book of short stories, which is not one single piece of literature, but it is technically literature. And that's 12 Pilgrim Stories by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Okay.
I can see you've got a few of his books up there, Brent. I've said this on the podcast before. He is my favorite author. And he has full-length novels that I adore, but these short stories are, like, they're some of my favorite stories I have ever read. A few of them are just, like, mind-blowing. And they're short, so very accessible. So that's my recommendation. I adore those stories.
What was the exact question one more time? Was it most influential?
Single greatest piece of literature you've ever read.
Greatest.
Yeah, so I'll be clear. I'm not answering this like the piece of literature that I've read that I think changed the world the most. I'm answering piece of literature that I've read that sort of accomplished two things. A, I enjoyed it massively, and B, I thought it was masterful in some way, not just something I enjoyed.
I feel like, so I got Goodreads this week, and it made me realize that I actually do not know that much about literature, even relative to how much I know about other areas of media. Like, there are some people out there who could give you a really good answer, and I'm not one of those people.
Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, one of my favorite books. Lolita. Nabokov, another one of my favorites.
I'm writing these recs down. I've heard of Lolita.
I've heard of both of these so far.
Oh yeah, Invisible Man, incredible. Yeah. Lolita, also incredible. Unsettling. I won't spoil it, even though you've probably heard what the premise is. Also a big fan of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude, one of my favorite books.
That's my favorite, of his. Yeah.
I've only read Chronicle of a Death Foretold, but it was a good book.
Yep. So. I'm a big fan of Cormac McCarthy. So The Road, Blood Meridian... All the Pretty Horses.
Yeah, All the Pretty Horses was one of my favorite books I've ever read.
I just love his style. Who else? I'm a big fan of Dennis Johnson, and he has a book of short stories called Jesus's Son, that is very dark, but very good.
Okay. Written down.
What else? What else are my favorites? Yeah, I think that's a solid. That's a solid list.
That is a solid list.
Yeah,
that is a very solid list. Mm. Yeah, 100 Years of Solitude. I've talked about that on that book on this podcast before. Yeah. I love that book, and yeah. Cormac McCarthy's great.
Yeah. Oh, also I love Don Quixote. I know some of these books are very Western literature canon, but I do love Don Quixote. Makes me laugh out loud, or made me laugh out loud when I read it.
That's a good answer. Yeah, I mean, I don't think you need to be subversive answering these questions. I don't think you need to... no, those are good answers. I have another question. This is one we do often. What music are you currently listening to?
What am I listening to right now? Honestly, this is just a busy time of the semester. For me, we're close to finals week, so I'm grading. So I'm not listening to anything with words. Yeah, I'm just listening to a bunch of jazz, bunch of lo-fi, Afrobeats, lo-fi hip-hop, classical music. Just, yeah, almost exclusively for the last couple of weeks. Other than Not Like Us, which has been stuck in my head for 2 weeks nonstop.
Wah, 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 wah.
Yep. Yeah. That might be one of the only songs with words that I've listened to multiple times in the last 2 weeks.
It's a good one. If you're going to have only one, it's a good one.
Yeah.
I've had that stuck in my head for 10 days.
Yeah, yeah. I randomly say lines from that song out loud. Can't help it. It's like a compulsion.
Aaron, how about you?
I can do new and old. I think I said this on a previous podcast. I don't know, but I was working until the end of April. I've now returned to school, but at work I had to write a lot of code. And so common practice is just to listen to music. So I ended up listening to a ton of music in the first quarter of this year. I feel like my favorite new album from this year so far is the new Vampire Weekend album.
I actually haven't listened to it.
Only God Was Above Us. I think it's really good. I grew up as a classical pianist, and I've always loved rock bands. So Vampire Weekend's kind of like a happy marriage of those two for me. I am looking forward to listening to. So during the lockdown, Childish Gambino released an incomplete version of a project, and he has just released. He has just taken it down and released the completed version of it on, I think, Monday, so the 13th. And I'm looking forward to going to listen to that. I thought the incomplete project had some promising moments, but a lot of it just didn't make any sense because it was incomplete. And so I'm hopeful that the complete version will be as good as some of his older stuff, which I liked. In terms of older music, I've been listening to primarily jazz and funk, namely Headhunters by Herbie Hancock. That's a classic. I feel like it has a lot of roots in now modern EDM and jazz. It's really great if you're into either of those genres. I think it's not quite as percussive as modern EDM, but it has a lot of the electronic elements of it. And Case, last time we had this segment, you told me that I had to listen to Pimp a Butterfly, which I already knew, but I have finally gone and listened to it, and I think I've listened to it about 15 times since
I knew you'd love
I first
album.
Listened to it. Yeah. It is really, really great. Yeah. It's one of, if not the best album from the last 10 years, for sure. Yeah. In my
I would like to take this opportunity to again shame you for having never listened to it before.
It's one of those things that I've always known would be really good, but I wanted to be ready and in the headspace to listen to it. It's not just modern pop fare that I can kind of switch on for half an hour, listen to it, put it down, maybe revisit it a week later. It's one of those things that I felt like I had to be. A friend of mine keeps using the phrase locked in as a joke, but you have to be locked in to really appreciate, I think.
It's also not summertime music. You have to listen to that before the weather gets too nice.
Yeah, it was the heat of the winter, or the cold of the winter, I guess, when I was listening to it. So yeah. And then it's also sent me down like a rap train. Like I've been listening to a few different rappers since. I think most recently was Doom. Nice. Which I've been really enjoying.
Oh, R.I.P. Like,
I know. But yeah.
Those are good answers. So to continue with the Kendrick theme, this whole beef has brought me back to Mr. Morale and the Big Steppers. So I've been listening to that like nonstop. I already love that album, but it grows on me every time I listen to it. I love that album. But otherwise, I guess I'll hit on two things. Brent, you were talking about instrumental music. There's an album that I think I recommended on the podcast before by Tiny, who's like this reggaeton like producer called Data, but he also released a instrumental version of the album that like I work to all the time now. So that's been big because I'm leaving on vacation end of this week. I've had a lot of work to do. That's been going in my headphones. And then the last thing I've been listening to is the last artist I've been listening to is Feyruz, who's, I think a lot of our listeners, especially from the Middle East, will know who she is. She's this uber famous Lebanese singer. Her music is amazing. It's incredibly beautiful. Those have been like the three main things taking up my ear space recently. Those are my answers.
Yeah, Headhunters is also 100% instrumental. I forgot to mention that before, but that was one of the reasons why I
brought it up. Yeah,
it is fully instrumental. And so is I've also been listening to, if you want more instrumental jazz, this is a classic, but Scenery by Ryo Fukui. He's like a classic jazz pianist. It's one of the like quintessential jazz albums, particularly from East Asia in the I believe late 70s, but I could be wrong. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just adding these to my list.
That one's more of like a ambient, calm afternoon. Whereas the Herbie Hancock album is a lot more upbeat.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess if I'm gonna hit on mood, the instrumental album I suggested is definitely like you've over caffeinated yourself and you need to get something done. Like that's definitely the energy for that. Feyruz is like, I don't even know what the context would be for that. It's very dramatic, though. It's for, like, a walk on a beautiful evening, I would say. It's very cinematic, orchestral music. But, yeah. Well, I think that wraps up that wraps up No Details. Thank you so much for coming on. This was great. This is, I think, the most energetic episode we've had in a while because it's been hard to keep the energy high. And we know you're busy because, obviously, like you said, you got grading to do. So really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you guys having me on. I'm a fan. You know, besides us being friends, I'm also a fan of the podcast. I think you guys do a great job. I listen every week. Always enjoy it. So, yeah, happy to be on.
I mean, I'm passionate about what we do, but you definitely bring something to it that I don't think we've had the last few months. So thanks, Brent. Thanks, everyone. And we'll see you next week. Or in 2 weeks, actually. Hope you enjoyed this week's Devils in the Details. You can follow us at DevilsITDPod on Twitter or on a variety of streaming platforms. Our awesome theme music was made by Jacob Connor. You can find at Jacob J. Connor on Twitter. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.